Shayna, my dear.
Christopher.
I have a book title for you, just because it's, you know, just the two of us. I wanted to run this by you.
Okay.
Tell me what you think about this title. Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies, as a title of a book.
Reminds me of Carter Hayward's The 12 Deadly Sins of Christian, White Christian Nationalism. Nice. Sounds juicy.
It sounds juicy. We're going to have the author on our show.
Excellent.
Welcome to What in God's Name, the podcast of the S1 Project. She is Shayna Appel.
And he is Christopher Owen.
We are using the lenses of humanistic theology and moral philosophy to see more deeply into our shared common life.
Couldn't have said that better myself,
Chris.
Oh,
come on. Yes, you could have. We have a spinny wheel. We spin it at the beginning of our show. It gives us a chance to limber up, and it also gives us a chance to do a riff on one of 16 core values, key ideas that are essential for our project and our podcast. Shayna is going to give that puppy a spin.
Occasionally, Chris just randomly changes the topics, which keeps me on my toes. What's it on, Chris?
So the spinny wheel has landed on something that Shayna asked me about even just yesterday. And because she can't read my handwriting and because the segments of the spinny wheel are
on your
marked,
side of the studio.
They're marked with my handwriting. Programmatic secularism.
Programmatic secularism.
Or programmatic secularists.
Yes, those people who believe that faith has absolutely no place in the public square. We push back against programmatic secularists because we believe that the lens of theology, the lens of faith, has a great deal to offer to our public narrative. However, having said that...
Yeah, you can go ahead and add the second half to that.
Yeah, there are also those who think their faith tradition, the language of their faith, their beliefs, is the only faith that belongs in the public square, and we push back against them as well.
Yeah, this is the really tricky place to be. We're threading the needle, to use that metaphor, or, you know, steering between the rock and the hard place. And we invite you, our listening community, to join us in this project because it's, you know, there's no formula. formula for the correct answer.
Correct. There are few correct answers.
So, yeah, the programmatic secularist point of view is that religion ought to be private. Just keep it private. And out here in the public realm, we'll do something different. And I think increasingly we need to have the kinds of moral conversations. And of course, moral conversations for religious people are going to be connected to religion. So we push back, as you said, we push back against the programmatic secularist that says religion is just private.
Bad religion is private. I would ask people to keep their bad theology to themselves. But, you know, just a brief historical note here. There is one narrative that talks about the Judeo-Christian scriptures, the Judeo-Christian religion, in fact, emerging at a time where humanity was moving from being hunter-gatherers to more agrarian. And as they settled down and claimed land, and you had to know which land you could graze your sheep on and which land might belong to someone else, it necessitated some kind of fundamental agreements. And to their credit, I think these early settlers were asking the fundamental question underlying, you know, not just coming up with rules, but saying, what are the ethics and morality that underlie these rules? How shall we get along in this new world order? And I think it's good to remember that periodically.
Are you referring to the scriptures, like the Hebrew scriptures?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. the tone, indicating it is time for us to move to the topic of today's show.
Let me set it up, if I may, Shayna.
Tee it off, Chris.
So yesterday I was going to Shayna's house for a meeting, and I asked Shayna how she was doing, and she said...
And he got an earful.
I don't remember exactly what you said, because I'm not great at remembering exact quotes from people in particular situations like that.
Oh, admit it, Chris. You're just not all that great at caring what the hell I'm...
Oh, stop. So Shayna said something like, I'm not doing great. And I said, why? And then Shayna didn't say a word and walked over to her computer. And I was like, okay, she's ignoring me. I don't understand why she's going to her computer. This is not typical Shayna behavior. Shayna will answer questions with words, spoken words. So she pulled up on the computer a piece of writing that she had done and said something like, I needed to write it down.
Well, as Chris knows...
Even if you didn't say that, I'm making it up. Chris, you said I needed to write it down.
I have to, because Chris, as you well know, I'm an external processor.
Yeah.
I don't do my best thinking inside my head. I have to either be in conversation with people, or another way that I process is to write.
Yeah. So, and let me just tee it up a little bit more, and then you get to go. So, as our listening community knows, our essential question and the conversations that we've had at the beginning of this season have been about the moral foundations of democracy. Today, we're taking a pause to talk about the situation in the Middle East, and that is what Shayna pulled up on her computer when she invited me to read this yesterday. So today's a special edition, just a pause. Sometimes we do this when certain things are happening in the world and we want to give some theological reflection. And so I read what Shayna wrote and I said to Shayna, this is tomorrow's show. So
here we are. So as many of our listeners know, I was raised Jewish and still identify as Jewish, both faithfully as well as culturally. I attended seminary as a Unitarian Universalist, chose a Christian seminary to overcome my fear of all things Christian, probably overshot the mark a little bit, wound up coming out and getting ordained in the United Church of Christ. In large part, what made that possible was the Committee on Ministries stance that baptism did not wash away the mark of my Judaism. Both of my parents are Jewish, and I did not choose to wash that mark away. I simply chose to, I guess, turn the back page of the Hebrew scriptures and keep on reading. And
that's great.
You know, at Andover Newton Theological School is a progressive seminary. I had wonderful professors who introduced me to Rabbi Jesus. I identify faithfully as Judeo-Christian, Buddhist appreciative, and occasionally pagan worshiping, which is probably how I ended up as a Unitarian Universalist, even though I still have one foot firmly planted with my beloveds in the United Church of Christ. Anyway, so the feces hits the oscillating rotator in Israel. There is a brutal attack by Hamas, and Israel is caught totally off guard, and my first assumption is that there's going to be a disproportionate response. To be clear, I am a person who stands both for Israel and for Palestine, primarily because I think as human beings, we have to be called to see each other's humanity. And so I'm less concerned about the politics of the situation and more concerned with how it is we shall learn to get along. Anyway, so as I was processing the complicated feelings that I've been having, and perhaps some of our listeners have been having too, this is what came out on the page. I wrote, I am an American genderqueer Jew, and I am terrified right now for innocent civilians in both Israel and Palestine, and for Jews everywhere as anti-Semites around the world view the Hamas slaughter as permission to hit the gas pedal on their own hatred. I am pissed as hell at Hamas for unleashing what promises to be a disproportionate response by Israel, and pissed even further into hell by the Israeli government's inability to resist being goaded into that response. I am breathless with fear as I await the outcome for hostages taken by Hamas, women, children, persons with disabilities, the elderly, and breathless with fear for the lives of Palestinian women, children, persons with disabilities, and the elderly. I am watching in despair as Western media attempts to report this disaster, all the while seemingly blind to the prism through which they view the so-called facts on the ground. I am sensitive to those who feel called to stand in solidarity with Israel in light of the Hamas massacre, and sensitive to those who stand with the Palestinian people, recognizing the consequences decades of occupation have inflicted. I am incredibly grateful for the one friend who reached out to me to see how I'm holding up in the midst of this human disaster, recognizing without having to be told how deeply distressing these events are for those of us who carry the identity Jewish or Palestinian or maybe simply human. I am praying for the peacemakers, for I was led to believe they would be recognized as the children of God, even as I find myself wondering how much clout God has in a conflict too many have blamed on them. I am awaiting the reign of the meek, who Jesus said would inherit the earth. Where the hell are you guys? I am terrified, pissed, breathless with fear, watching in despair, sensitive, incredibly grateful, praying, awaiting. How are you all holding up?
It's a tough time to be human and kind.
Yeah, that is so.
And I think it's also a tough time, but a really necessary time for us to dig down, again, doing what we do on the show all the time, Chris, digging down beneath the politics.
Yeah.
To stay with matters of human flourishing, or in this case, just, you know, the value of human life.
Yeah. So glad you said that. So in my notes, I made a note to myself saying, okay, explain to our listening community why this, why did we choose to have you read this? And it's exactly what you just said. It's an example of this humanistic theological reflection that we are promoting in our project. And more specifically, what does that mean? And I think it means a couple of things. One is it begins, so sometimes you can think of theology as taking you outside of the world into some very abstract place, but humanistic theological reflection starts with the experience of being human. And so one of the reasons why this works so well for us is that you begin with your human experience. And the second reason it works theologically is because it's authentic and vulnerable. And that is always healing power in the world. Because when I hear you be vulnerable and honest and authentic, it just opens people up. Mm-hmm. It's a gift. It really always is a gift mm-hmm. for others. So and God is at work, certainly, in that for those of us who have that commitment. And then the other piece of this that is human and theological is the complexity, just the complexity, and how. And I want to look at specific pieces of what you wrote, but how you captured that complexity with, like, I've been to the Middle East and I've talked to people and. Understandably, people get dug in and can only feel the pain of their own side. And that happens every, it doesn't have to be the Middle East. It can be here too. But I think what our spiritual journey, our religious faith calls us to is to recognize the complexity and the humanity that's there. It's all around and on each side. That isn't, you know, you say each side and then I always catch myself because I always want to add, like, it's not every situation is, you know, you want to split the middle and everybody's equal to blame or none of that. No. It's merely the observation that there are human beings involved, mm-hmm. no matter what. So the complexity, that's another piece of it. You do so beautiful job here of holding the complexity, not trying to unravel it, but to hold it up just and say, this is complex.
Just to hold it. And, you know, I would say that a couple of things. One, I think I said to you a number of years ago that this being with you in this time that we share together on the podcast has really become a church for me. And I have learned a lot here in conversation with both you and Brandon, that ability to simply sit with the complexity is what we've been working on in the show and what we're inviting our listeners to engage with us in. And while I know we're not on topic today per se with respect to democracy, the moral foundations of democracy, I would suggest that a democratic nation needs its citizens to be able to hold complex ideas that often are in opposition to one another. Yeah. To know that two things can absolutely be true. And in fact, once you see the two things are true, then you start to see all the subtleties in the middle, that being able to hold those ideas at one time requires us to suspend judgment. And I think this is, you know, where faith, you know, well practiced, teaches us humility. It teaches us that no matter how cocksure we are about something, we might be wrong. No matter how certain we are, or regardless of our experience, somebody else has another experience, and both of those things are equally true. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, years of faith practice that can teach over time, that really change the fabric of one's soul, to be more humble and to not jump into knowing, are so critical and one of the foundational pieces, cornerstones that's missing right now in our nation. Mm-hmm. Not only are fewer and fewer people attending church, but we are not teaching morality. We are not teaching all of that. And anyway, so I've slipped back into the topic of the year. We can come back into the writing. I think you had some questions or some thoughts.
Yeah, I did. Well, so here's one thought, Shana. I'll just tee this up by relating that we talked about this a little bit at the dinner table as a family, and you know, what do you think about what's going on and so forth. And my understanding, the way I frame it, is it's an impossible situation between Israel and Hamas. You have, Hamas is dedicated to basically stating that Israel should not exist. So how does Israel respond to that? Gaza is kind of an impossible place to live.
On a good day,
the Israelis are boxed into a corner. Hamas is boxed into a corner where it's impossible to see a way forward. And so my question, this is a theological question, I guess, do you believe that God can do something about those impossible places where people have intractable difference? And does it have to work through people? I guess it does. I don't know, man. Here's some theological reflection.
Yeah, I guess that's a big question. I do think It has to work through people. And I think God is so present with those who struggle that, you know, to look at a place like Gaza and not see the presence of God everywhere. I mean, anyone who's done mission work or, you know, who's gone out, you know, and worked at a soup kitchen or, you know, knows that there's something special. There's a feeling when you walk into the place of people just being human and kind to mm-hmm. each other. That there's a special presence there. Some of us would call God.
Mm-hmm.
I think that at this point, the biggest, and this may sound incredibly naive to people who know way more than I do, but I think from where I sit, it looks to me like the biggest problem right now is the Israeli government and Hamas. And if you were to get rid of both, you'd find Palestinians and Israelis who simply want to live in peace and to live lives of security. And by security, I mean not just, you know, safety, but to have food, to be able to educate their children, to hope for a better tomorrow for their children. Yes, to live in safety.
Mm-hmm.
But Hamas is so entrenched. And, you know, not for nothing, but my political analysis is that Israel got caught with its pants down. And now the government needs to stand up and get the big guns blowing because they want, you know, they don't want to be seen by their own people as having been caught asleep at the helm, which they were absolutely caught asleep at the helm. So now we find ourselves in this place where these political parties are acting out of politics and politics alone, and there just doesn't seem to be any room for humanity. And I don't honestly know. I mean, I was thinking about what it takes to turn human beings in such a way as they are capable of the violence that Hamas unleashed on innocent children. And I mean, that's you know, terrorism.
Yeah.
Okay. That they specifically went after civilians. Of course, power is now out in Gaza.
Yep.
The hospitals are running on whatever last fuel they have on their generators. Food has been cut off. Water has been cut off. I think the world recognizes that that is a violation of I don't know how many UN sanctions, but that is not okay. You're now going to ruthlessly punish civilians. It's just an overall lack on both sides, the inability of both sides at this point. And when I say both sides, I am referring to Hamas and the Israeli government. Yeah. Is certainly there are civilians on both sides who, you know, follow the party line, but the party line that's being led has absolutely nothing to do with the humanity of the other. Hmm. It can only see its own humanity, its own injury. But to turn a human being into the kind of animal that could just, you know, mow families down on both sides of the track, because it's happening. Yeah. Let me be clear. It's happening in Gaza right now.
Right.
I, you know, what is the level of hurt and the level of trauma
right.
that is so deeply embedded in both sides? And it, you know, that's where the bloodletting needs to happen.
Yeah. I think you've, identified some key dynamics in that. Let me just raise one more theological way into seeing this situation, and then we'll need to leave it. But I was prompted to this reflection based on some of your comments about political power, and certainly in Christian theology, we have ways of understanding. This gets back to my other question about God.
Give to Caesar what is due Caesar, and give to God what is due God.
No, I'm thinking of something else, which is worldly power and God's power, and some of what Paul wrote in Corinthians. The idea that God's power. And this is in the Hebrew scriptures as well, that God's power works through the humble, and that there's a power that is more powerful, even though it looks like weakness. And that eventually that's the power that wins. I mean, that's an affirmation of faith. It doesn't ever look that way. I mean, if you think about the underdog and those who are powerless, they never look like they're going to conquer the tanks and the guns and the machine guns and the bombs and the missiles. That's the worldly power. So somewhere, somehow, I have to believe, I have to believe that God is working through those who have no power. And that somehow through that powerlessness, a new future emerges. Who knows how? I'm just speaking theologically.
I agree.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of digesting what you just said, because it's incredibly challenging.
And that's the theology. That is the theology.
That is
right?
The theology. Yes, it's incredibly challenging, and I also think incredibly right. I mean, in looking back over the course of the entire history of humanity, looking at where we might find God's presence certainly does not reign in triumphalism.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
On the other hand, it's really challenging, I think, it's challenging for me as an American,
yeah,
and somebody inculcated into a culture that says, you know, I must be in control and direct my own life, and power is good, and you know, all the things that we are, all the things that culture teaches us to embrace in the realm of God are things to be let go of, right? The rich man comes to Jesus and Jesus says to him, you know, the rich man wants to know, how shall I get into the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus says, just, you know, get rid of everything you own. And we're told the rich man walked away and was very sad, as I think most of us would be, you know, just kind of get rid of all your stuff and, you know, be homeless, be, you know, I mean, I think it's telling too, when Jesus sent the disciples out, you know, he sent them out with a couple of tunics, but you know, that was it. They were to rely on the kindness of others. If you have a listening in this town, great, stick around. If you don't, kick the dust off your sandals and move on. Well, you know, easier said, but if it's sunset and you're hungry, you know, you might be tempted to tell somebody what they want to hear just to maybe, I don't know, get dinner out of them. But, you know, I think Jesus would say it's better to walk away hungry.
Right. Right. I mean, there's a craziness to say that there's a power in powerlessness. It just turns the world upside down.
It turns the world upside down and is the only, it is the starting point for millions of people who have walked out of addiction.
Yeah, well, there you go.
The moment you admit you're powerless over your addiction, it's the first step in a 12-step program.
Right.
We came to see that alcohol, drugs, sex, shopping, whatever, food, you know, took control of our lives and that we were powerless over it.
Yeah.
And once you've done that, what happens is you immediately have a new power.
Hmm.
I mean, that's the irony.
It's the power. Is it the that's the power of surrender?
The power of surrender.
Which, I mean, it's bringing that back to the political realm, like, good luck on that.
Yeah.
Like, how is that gonna look?
Right.
So I'm fully aware that to the rational mind and to the realistic vision of what can happen, it seems not possible.
I think it's not only possible, I think it is necessary. And again, this is coming back to that, you know, being able to hold a plurality
right.
of
yeah.
ideas,
yeah. All right.
You know, to be able to hold in one hand, right? I mean, when I was at Andover Newton Theological School, we were taught to write our sermons with the Boston Globe in one hand and the scriptures in the other. You know, to be in the world, just not exclusively of it.
Yeah.
Is not an either or proposition. It's a both and.
I want to thank you for your writing and your sharing it.
Thanks for letting me share it, Chris. And, you know, to all of our listeners out there who are, you know, who identify as carry the identities of Jewish, Palestinian, both or neither, but who are allies and feeling this pain and feeling a conflagration of emotional responses. I hope this has helped. If you want to read it, did we post it someplace?
You know what? I'm going to put it in the show notes, so it will be right with the podcast. So if you process more by reading than by listening, you'll be able to see it there.
And if you want to share it with anyone else, do so with my blessing.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light. Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. If you are a generous donor on Patreon, we are so grateful for your support. And if you have been a listener for a while, and maybe now's the time for you to join our generous donors by becoming a generous donor yourself, patreon.com, and look for What in God's Name in the search bar. If you would like to sign up for our newsletter and stay in touch, we are still in the transition from our old website to our new. So send me an email directly, whatingods@ribeyemedia.com. That's whatingods, one word, at ribeye, R-I-B-E-Y-E, dash, media, M-E-D-I-A.com. That's too bad. We don't get to spell What in God's together. But we'll figure out something
else. We'll figure out some other way to close. Thanks for taking the time today, Chris.
Yeah, great to be with you, Shana.